The purpose of this session is primarily to challenge our thinking, especially those who are in leadership and church leadership and who participate in preparing for the worship service. Also, those who actually participate in the worship service. So really, it applies to everyone. Is to challenge our thinking about how we do our worship services. In other words, the methodology of our worship. Unfortunately, many church leaders really put little thought into preparing their worship service. I traveled on a music team for the university that I attended, and I was in hundreds of churches throughout a semester, and it always amazed me to observe some of the church leaders, whether it was a pastor or a music pastor, frantically flipping through the index of his hymnal 5 minutes before the service, choosing some hymns to use for that service in 5 minutes. And it just evidenced to me that church leadership really put little thought into the hymns that are chosen, and if that is really thought through very little, then certainly other elements of the service certainly are thought through very little as well. And so one of the primary purposes of this workshop is simply to challenge our thinking. I'm going to be giving some suggestions as far as methodology is concerned, and they're not to be taken as if I'm saying that these are the only way we can do things. They're simply some suggestions to stimulate our thinking and make us really want to think through our services more than we really do. I attended a similar workshop to this recently at another conference, and the purpose of the workshop was to help the workshop attenders figure out how best to order their services, and we're going to talk about that today too. But what I came away with was that the primary criterion for how I order my service is what people like. That was what the basis of the workshop was. What will best make people feel comfortable? What will make people feel involved? What will make people feel not bored? And so the major fundamental criteria for my worship order, my service order, were people. Now, that's important. There are practical considerations to take into mind, but I don't think that is the most important criterion for our decision making. Really, for every Christian, our decisions should really have a scriptural, theological basis as its foundation. You could do your service completely different than how I do mine, and we both could still be pleasing to the Lord as long as our methodology is flowing from the same scriptural, theological basis and similar philosophical principles. Unfortunately, many Christians really skip the first two steps. They skip right to the methodology, and they don't really worry about what the scriptures have to say or the philosophy that flows from it. But really, a person's methodology is a foolproof indicator of what the person really believes theologically. Someone can say he has a certain theological belief, but if his methodology doesn't match it, then he really doesn't believe what he says he does. Our methodology is a window into what we really think and what we really believe. In deciding what we're going to include in our worship service and what our methodology is going to be and our service order and those sorts of really practical decisions, our primary objective should be that the service really facilitates true worship. This means that truth needs to be presented in the service and the response to that truth is given. Methodologies change over time. Different cultures, different circumstances, methodologies are different. But the theology, where we get our scriptural principles and our philosophy, shouldn't change. So now let's spend the rest of our time challenging our thinking regarding methodology. And I want to encourage you, as we move into this, don't allow yourself to have the mentality that, well, we've always done it this way, therefore we just need to keep doing it this way. The purpose of this workshop is to challenge us to think through how we do things. And like I said, the methodological suggestions I give are not inspired. They're not from the mouth of God. They're simply to get our minds thinking. And those of us who are in leadership in planning the service, hopefully we'll start thinking a little more carefully about why we do what we do. And those of us who are not involved in any kind of leadership, but are just in the pew worshiping, the intent here is to help us think through what we're doing in the midst of a worship service. Now, we've seen that true worship has two parts: a presentation of truth and a response to that truth. So it's important, as we move into our methodology, what are we going to include in the service? How are we going to order our service? What kinds of things are we going to do in our service? It's important that both be present. Often churches will err on one side or the other. You'll have churches that really facilitate a lot of response, but no reason for the response. I think that's the natural failure of a lot of modern contemporary churches. A lot of praise, 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 but no reason for the praise. Many of our churches probably err on the other side. A lot of doctrine, a lot of truth, but maybe not the necessary avenues for correct response to that truth. So I want to encourage us as we move into this to think about including both worship and response. First of all, establishing purpose. The church exists for many reasons, biblically. Some of which are worship, evangelism, discipleship, fellowship, mutual assistance, expansion, things of that nature. And local churches gather at different times during the week to accomplish those purposes. So it's really important in this whole idea of thinking through why we're doing things and what we're doing, it's important that church leaders decide which purpose or purposes they intend to accomplish at a given meeting. What purposes of the church are we going to try to accomplish Sunday morning? What purposes Sunday night, Wednesday night, whenever other times your church meets? Now, some purposes fit better with others. For instance, fellowship and mutual assistance are both horizontal, and they involve church members interacting with each other. Evangelism naturally goes hand in hand with expansion, with church planting or missions. But some purposes, by their very nature, work better when they are the exclusive focus, when they are accomplished on their own. And worship, I think, is one of these purposes. Because worship is inherently vertical, responses to God, because of truth about God, other purposes that are more horizontal often hinder worship from happening. Now, does this mean that no horizontal activities will happen during worship? Well, no, because worship is intrinsically congregational. It's corporate. We link arms with the other believers. Awareness of others is important. However, if we try to mix in things like fellowship times and more casual horizontal kinds of activities in a more vertical focused service, that might be a distraction. Fellowship time during a worship service would draw people's attention away from the vertical focus. In the same way, though discipleship occurs during the worship service, especially during the preaching, more in-depth discipleship can be accomplished better when it's really the exclusive focus, when there's one-on-one attention going on. The point is this: church leaders need to determine what specific purposes will be addressed at a particular gathering. For instance, Sunday school may be used primarily for discipleship. Church may have a designated fellowship time, and then many churches reserve Sunday morning for congregational worship. Those are just some suggestions. The Bible doesn't explicitly tell us how churches need to fulfill their responsibilities. The important thing is that we think through it, and we decide these are when we're going to do, when we're going to fulfill our biblical purposes. Now, what are some methodological principles we can draw from all of this? And these are just some suggestions. These are what we have done at our church just to govern and to help guide what we do and where we place certain functions of our church. First of all, since worship is required of all believers, congregational involvement in all aspects of the service should be encouraged. Okay, if we see in the Bible that every believer is supposed to worship God, then it is crucial, and this is a methodological principle that we'll springboard off of, it is crucial that congregational involvement is encouraged in the service. And because of this, congregational singing is one of the most important elements of the worship service. It's the one element when everyone verbally does something together. And so it's crucial that congregational worship be emphasized, congregational singing specifically. Secondly, the primary purpose of instruments, choirs, and other groups should be to encourage congregational singing. Why do I have a choir standing up in the loft? Why do I have an orchestra sitting down in an orchestra pit? The primary purpose, among others, but the primary purpose is to encourage congregational involvement. This is not entertainment. This is not an opportunity for people to perform. It's not a spotlight on one or two people. It should always be an emphasis on everyone participating. The whole congregation is worshiping together, and the purpose of these other, quote-unquote, worship leaders, and that's not necessarily a bad term, the purpose of them is to help lead in the worship and help specifically the congregational singing when we're talking about music. The primary purpose of music other than congregational singing, such as music performed by instrumentalists, choir, small groups, or individuals, should be to aid and lead the congregational worship. And so this is going to govern our choices of what we sing in our choir, or what an instrumentalist plays, or what a vocal soloist sings. What is their primary purpose? Their primary purpose is to lead and aid the congregation in worship. And then four, in all musical endeavors, churches should seek to present God with an excellent offering, not shoddy, shallow, or governed by fleeting cultural trends, but that which is pregnant with biblical doctrine and heartfelt Godward response. If our worship is supposed to be a biblical response to God as a result of an understanding of biblical truth about God, then we owe God an excellent offering. Now, that does not mean complex. That does not mean virtuosic, and we'll see that in a minute. Something simple can still be excellent. But the whole mentality of pray for us, we ain't practiced much, is certainly not biblical if we're trying to give God an excellent offering. Now let's talk about preparation for congregational worship. I think this is one of the most overlooked necessities when it comes to congregational worship. Think about your life on a typical Sunday morning. Our lives are hectic. We're racing to get ready in the morning. If you've got kids, you're dressing your kids. You pack them in the car. You forget something, you run back. You run to church. You chase everybody to Sunday school. You're taking off boots and hats and coats and hanging everything up, and you're running to Sunday school. After Sunday school, you're picking everything up. You got about 15 minutes to run and get a drink of water and use the restroom and run into the service. And you're all exhausted. You drop your kids off at the nursery, and the service starts. And it isn't until about the third hymn when you finally feel like you've calmed down and you can really start thinking about what you're doing. Isn't that the case often? I think we need to put a little more thought into this. Why don't we provide, before our worship services, a time to prepare ourselves? Now, this is not necessarily some kind of mystical, spiritual time when people are ushered into the presence of the Lord. It's simply a practical time of calming our minds so that we can focus on worship when it's time to start. We do this in our church, and it has worked really well. 5 minutes before the service, we invite everyone to come into the auditorium. Everyone's quiet. We play music. We put up the words to the music on the screen so people can meditate on the truth. We encourage people to pray, read the Bible. It's not some mystical time, but it's a great time for people to simply calm their minds and begin preparing themselves for the worship service. This is something that we need to rethink. How are we giving our people, as leaders of the church, are we giving our people an opportunity to prepare themselves to worship? Or are we really helping them in their hindrance? Now let's talk about the service of worship itself. the elements that we include in our service, the order of the service, and these sorts of things. Now, we defined congregational worship as a unified chorus of biblical responses toward God, expressed publicly to God, resulting from an understanding of biblical truth about God. If we agree on that definition, if we agree on that basic scriptural theology of congregational worship, then every element in the service should fulfill that purpose. And anything that we want to include that would distract from that, we should eliminate. So remember, every element of the service should facilitate congregational worship, presentation of truth, and then response to that truth, or some combination of both. The first way we can do this is emphasizing that every single member of the congregation is a participant. That is all of us. It's not just the people in the choir, it's not just the pastor, it's not just the instrumentalist, it's every single person in the congregation is a participant. A spectator mentality of people in the pews is easy to develop, but it's clearly anti-biblical. People should be engaged in worship at all times. If there's any lag between certain events in the service, we should use that time for prayer. I tell the people in our church, you know, if there's a lag between a hymn and a trumpet solo, don't sit there and think, oh, why watch the guy walk up and think, boy, he should have been there up there before. Now, what took him so long? No, use that time to praise the Lord for the truth you just sang. We have a kind of program, big production mentality when it comes to our services. Everything's got to be boom, 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 and the light cues have to be just right, and the people have to be in the right place at the right time. There can be no lag time, and everything has to go boom, 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 right in order. I would argue that that's more of a program, production kind of mentality than it is a congregational worship mentality. We should not be afraid of lag time. This is just kind of a little pet peeve of mine. For instance, how many times does a congregation bow for prayer, and then when they open their eyes after the prayer, all of a sudden, magically, an ensemble has appeared on the steps of the church? Now, let me ask you a question. If every believer is supposed to worship all the time during the service, were those people who were marching into place during the prayer, were they involved in the prayer? As they stomped into place and created a distraction, did that facilitate true worship? You see, I think our concern with our services being this pristine, polished production really often hinders true worship. And we need to get rid of that mentality. We may not have rock music and we may not have strobe lights and entertainment, but we're not very far from that kind of error when we view our services as a production and we're so afraid of dead time or lag time and those sorts of things. So the congregation as participants. And this is why I will insist that congregational singing is so crucial, and we need to teach our people and those of you who are not actively involved in the stage ministry, we need to understand that every believer is responsible to sing, whether or not we can sing beautifully or not. Congregational singing is one of the most important aspects of our worship service. It's the one event when every member of the congregation can verbally worship the Lord together. And so congregations should make good use of this time to understand the biblical truth that's expressed in the hymns and then respond to the Lord with their affections. And that's why it's put to music in the first place, because music, it helps with that affectionate response. Now let's talk about worship leaders. We've talked about the congregation. So let's talk about the people up front now. What is their purpose? What is their function? How can we hone in and consider their purpose? We said a moment ago that the purpose of the music director, orchestra, choir, and other musicians is to lead the congregation in worship. Their purpose is not to entertain. Their purpose is not to perform. Their purpose is to lead the congregation. So this flows into a number of different applications. First of all, during an instrumental number, if I'm up here playing trombone, or if You know, someone's playing a piano solo. What should the congregation do? What should we encourage the congregation to do? The congregation should be encouraged to meditate on the words of the hymn and to contemplate the truth and to notice how the musical arrangement strengthens the message of the text. If you don't know the words of the hymn, open the hymnal. This is why I think it's so crucial and important that we provide for our people the words to instrumental numbers. If the words are not provided, then what is the value in terms of worship? There's value. The music glorifies God in and of itself. But if our specific purpose is congregational worship, then the words are important. And if there's an instrumental number going on, we've got to provide the words for our people. You can do this a number of ways. You could print the words in the bulletin. You could print the hymn number in the bulletin. You could announce the hymn number to the people. We have big screens on the walls of our church, and though we sing out of a hymnal, during instrumental numbers, we put the words up on the screen, along with the hymn number if someone wants to look at additional stanzas. But it's important that we remove this performer mentality, and we're all sitting here watching the performer, and we encourage worship, and we encourage understanding of truth in response to that truth. I tell the people at my church all the time, if I'm playing a trombone solo and you never look up at me, I won't be offended. I'll be happy about that. I don't want people looking at me. I want them looking at the truth, looking at the text, looking at the words of the hymn and contemplating the truth. During vocal numbers, because the words are there, we should strive to worship along with the group or the soloist and understanding truth and responding with them. The music is going to aid in that learning of truth and the expression of the response. And if the song teaches doctrine, we should seek to understand it and respond to it. If the song primarily expresses a response, we should strive to join in with the musicians of that response. The focus here is the musician's purpose is leadership, and all of the congregation should be involved at all times. Third, word from God, the preaching. We should view preaching as the primary time when God speaks during the service. I mean, this is the time when believers are confronted with clear biblical truth from God. And so we should make every attempt to be sensitive to conviction based on that truth. Because worship only occurs when we acknowledge the truth and then respond to it with action or affection. Since every believer is responsible to respond to truth, pastors really should provide a time for response after the Word of God is preached. Responding to truth is not the responsibility only of those who, quote unquote, feel convicted or raise their hands. All believers are responsible to respond to truth. And this is why our modern practice of invitations, we may need to think through it carefully. Invitations are not evil in and of themselves, but if we give the people the mentality that the only people that need to respond are those who come forward or raise their hands, that's incorrect. It's unbiblical. Every person always needs to respond. So how we accomplish this at our church is after our pastor is done preaching, we have two to three minutes of complete silence where people can think about how the truth applies to them, where people can pray and ask the Lord for forgiveness, where people can contemplate what they've heard. That way, every person is given the opportunity to respond. And then after that, we give people an opportunity to go to the back of the auditorium if they need help or whatever. But the important thing here is that every believer is given the opportunity to respond to truth, not just a certain few who raise their hand or come forward. Now, does order matter? Does it matter how we order our services? There are no prescribed service orders in the New Testament, obviously. But unfortunately, what this has done is it's led many churches to view their service order flippantly or maybe even just pragmatically. We don't put thought at all into our service, or the thought that we do put into our service is simply out of pragmatism or man-centered reasons. Church leaders really should put time into thinking through their order of service. Now, in order to flow from our theology and methodology, I think that our service order should accomplish two goals. Number one, how we order our service should make sure, we should make sure that true worship is really taking place. So anything that we can do in our service order to make sure that truth is presented and that response to that truth is given should be done. And then secondly, the second goal of our service order should be this. A service order should help the congregation actively involve themselves and readily recognize what they're doing. So our service order should make sure that worship is happening, but I think there's also benefit in ordering our service so that people can really see what's going on, and it can help them actively involve themselves. Now, this can be accomplished in many different ways. I'll just give you an example of how we do things at our church. One way to help the believers understand what worship is and what they're doing in the service is to group service elements that predominantly present truth separately from service elements that predominantly offer response. I group our services into one section at the beginning of the service that is all truth-based, primarily truth-based, and the second section of the service is primarily response. Is that some biblical, mystical, spiritual order of service? No. It's simply a practical way to help our people understand what worship is and what they're doing in the service. For instance, the first half of the service, we had a hymn, Holy, 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 vocal solo, I Know a Fount, a hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way, scripture reading, all truth-based things. And then after that, we had all response-based things. Praise ye the Lord, brass quintet, I sing the mighty power of God, choir, crown with many crowns, giving, O Jesus, I have promised, him, it is well with my soul. Since worship is a response to truth, I have all truth-based things at the beginning of the service, response-based things at the end of the service. So this means that in this particular order of service, my vocal solo was toward the beginning, my choir was toward the end. The next week, it might have been totally different. It just depends on what the choir is singing, what the vocal soloist is singing, what the instrumentalist is playing. Where they are in the service is dependent upon the content of their piece, not some kind of inflexible vocal solo needs to be before the message kind of order. I think of this kind of like a flexible liturgy. Things move around. Vocal solo could be the beginning here and the end next week, but they are placed at certain junctures in the service based on what the content of their pieces are. And I think basing it on the content of the piece is a lot more thoughtful than just having a plug-and-play keyhole in the wall kind of mentality. The kind of service order, this kind of service order may help the congregation understanding what they are doing and motivate them to actively participate. And using a bulletin or overhead projectors to tell people, hey, right now you're supposed to be acknowledging the truth of the sovereignty of God. Hey, right now you're supposed to be responding with praise through this hymn. That really helps people too. And I'd encourage you to think about that. Now, what about the music that's chosen then? How does our theology and philosophy of congregational worship affect the music that we choose? Only music that fits a biblical philosophy of congregational worship should be chosen. Sentimental, individualistic, private, intimate kind of music doesn't fit a congregational or affection or doctrine or God-oriented philosophy. There may be sacred music that's very intimate and personal, and it may be okay for my car or my home or my personal time of worship, but not for congregational worship. We need to be more thoughtful and more selective. Let's talk about announcements. Announcements are necessary for a church to function. People have to know what's happening in the ministry of the church. But this kind of horizontal intrusion, I think, can do much to hinder worship. And maybe we need to think through where we're going to have our announcements. Instead of plugging them right in the middle of a worship service, either do them a different time or put them in the bulletin or those sorts of things. I think we can be creative with how we do announcements. But the point is, throwing them right in the middle of a worship service can often do a lot to hinder true worship. Then number 8, special music. Let's talk a few moments about this and then we'll be done. Fundamentalists levy very weighty charges against contemporary worship styles. We often say that those who use contemporary music are more concerned with entertainment and drawing attention and performance, and those sorts of things. Unfortunately, these very same people that point out such offenses often fail their own charges with how we do our modern practice of quote-unquote special music. We may avoid rock music, and we may avoid clapping hands, and we may avoid drums, but are we any less performance-oriented? I mean, think about how we normally do quote-unquote special music. I mean, even the term itself, special music, suggests a kind of featured event mentality. It's almost as if the congregational hymn singing and other things are secondary, but the special music is a highlighted event. It's kind of a performance-oriented thing. Churches even make this mentality more prominent by how they order their services. Everybody knows that if you sing a vocal solo after the opening prayer and not right before the message, then you're kind of second string, right? I mean, the honored position is right before the message. And everybody knows that because that's how we do things. And we music directors know that's true. We put the better singers before the message, and we put the not as good singers at a different place. And all this is doing is encouraging a kind of performer mentality. And that's why we talked a moment ago about a different way to order our services. Another reason that I think we need to rethink our special music practices is that truth and clarity of truth are sacrificed by virtuosity and showmanship. I've got to show off my great talents on my instrument with all these runs and this extremely difficult music, and I've got to show off all of my skill and my talent. That is no less performance and entertainment oriented than the rock music. Instead, truth should be predominant. And I said a moment ago that excellence does not mean virtuosity, and the reverse is true. Simplicity does not imply shoddiness or non-excellence. Something can be simple and excellent all at the same time. And the point is, if the truth is magnified and the truth is emphasized, that's the key. This problem lies on is the fault of the people who choose the music. It's the fault of the leaders. We all need to rethink how we do quote-unquote special music. And this is also why we need to provide texts for instrumental numbers. That will help this performance mentality be quenched. Now, let's move to offerings and we'll be done. Offerings are often one of these kind of featured event times, aren't they? I mean, rarely do people really think about what they're doing during the times of giving. They throw their tax in the plate, and then they sit back and relax and enjoy the performance that's going on the stage. We've done things in our church to try to encourage true worship to take place during this time. One of them is to totally remove this whole special music element during our offering. Instead, we have a simple hymn of consecration played on the piano or organ. And that way people are encouraged to listen to the hymn. We give them the hymn number, and they're reading the hymn. They're contemplating the Lord's blessings to them, and then they're responding with their giving. And our ushers don't even come down until the second stanza of the hymn. So people are meditating. All they're doing is thinking about the Lord's blessing to them and how they should respond. And then the ushers come down and take up the offering. And that's just one way to try to discourage this featured event mentality in the offering and giving. Like I said, all of these suggestions, and we've flown through them, and we've hardly taken the adequate time to discuss all of them, all of these methodological suggestions are simply that, suggestions. And the primary purpose of this session was simply to encourage us to think through what we do and why we do it. And I want to challenge you, those of you who are in leadership, think more carefully through how you plan your services. Think through carefully about what things you choose to put in your services. Those of you who are involved in the music ministry, think more carefully through what music you choose. And those of you who are just in the pew, think through carefully what your job is. You are just as You should be just as involved as the music director, just as involved as the choir member, just as involved in the piano all the time, singing, contemplating truth, and responding with your affections to the Lord. Let's reconsider how we do things, and let's really try to think biblically regarding our methodologies of congregational worship.